You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Connor Coulson. This is Minute 87. This minute begins with Shaw still stumbling down the corridor and ends with a barbecued Fifield. And once more, I'm joined by Philip of the Matrix Minute and Twofold Podcast.
Sorry, okay.
Is that you rising from the ashes?
Yeah, I was trying to get into the mood, you know. This mood to this time, this minute is
lots of screaming.
Full of lots of screaming and lots of flamethrowers.
Yes. So, Fifield attacks the crewman and all hell breaks loose. This is in the garage area, so they've got flamethrowers, they're trying to run him over. There's a lot going on. And it's very hard to critique action scenes, or at least I find it hard. I tend to just zone out.
You're not wrong. Honestly, it's really, I've noticed for movies by minutes, at least this format, that it is extremely hard to describe action scenes and things where people don't talk much.
Yeah, unless you are someone who works in those sorts of things, if you're a stunt person, if you do some sort of martial arts yourself, know anything about choreography, then you've probably got an eye to go, okay, this is what they did and this is how it's accomplished. As for me, it's just things are going bad and people are being punched and there's a flamethrower. Yep.
That's it. Things going bad. People being punched and dying. Lots of blood. Blood's happening. There's a lot of bleeding.
Instead, I want to focus on some possibilities and minutiae, which is, well, let's face it, my kind of thing. So.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not a stranger to these observations.
So it turns out that they actually did film and even almost fully render a CGI version of Fifield, which I will put in the footnotes, and
this is true.
It looks a lot better.
I've just found this out a minute ago. Literally, almost.
Yeah.
Yeah, you showed me this, and I'm very surprised. I'm very shocked at the fact that this thing looks so rendered and finished, and they deleted it. And I'm very confused. Why?
I'm just, from the perspective of the logistics of making a film, I can't work that one out. I mean, I know they had a big budget on this and they threw it around quite willy-nilly, but you'd put all that effort in, so you film both with the makeup and with, I guess, a mocap suit or something, and then you just say, oh, we'll figure out which one's better in the edit?
That is, I don't know, like, obviously, that's what happened because it's finished, unless they retroactively, you know, kind of finished it and, you know, polished it for the Blu-ray release or, you know, the home video release. But, who knows?
Okay. So either they continued to animate that scene after the fact just so they could put it in the Blu-ray special features.
Like, that's sometimes releases like that happen, yeah.
Or is makeup Fifield a reshoot? I guess we'll never know.
Someone has to tell us, otherwise we wouldn't know.
Yes, that someone must know. It's like someone must know the answer to the mystery of Logan Marshall Green's tattoo. Those are the two big mysteries of this podcast, and I demand answers.
We demand answers. We demand the truth.
Wow, that's really a sentence. If you had to switch your accent, demand answers, demand answers. It's, yeah.
Demand answers. We demand answers. We demand answers over here in America.
Yeah, it's like sometimes puns and stuff will go over my head because I don't pronounce it the way they're assuming I'm going to pronounce it. And the example is psychopaths. And it was only until I heard an American say psychopath, I was like, oh, like psychopath. Oh, right.
Wait. I didn't think of that either. Wow, there you go.
It's very subtle.
No, it is a little too subtle, yeah. Psychopath.
Yeah. So, I'm glad this scene exists at least. It sort of gives you this, well,
oh, no, yeah.
If you're not happy with this one, well, here's another one. And you can...
Yeah. Can you, like, yeah, I was wondering, like, could you just put it into the finished movie? Because it looks practically finished. No one's going to...
You really could.
No one's going to see the difference.
So literally that entire scene from beginning to end is basically rendered. There's no cutting around it. You can literally just pop that scene in there and it works.
Yeah, you just pop it in. You know, speaking of deleted scenes, I'm very disappointed in... This is a little bit of a tangent, but I think that this is what the podcast is a little bit known for at this point.
Maybe.
I'm not sure.
Yes.
Will you allow it? Will you allow it?
We'll see.
Okay, well, speaking of deleted scenes, what I'm disappointed in is... In this case, we have a wonderfully... This movie, the deleted scene that you sent me, I'm assuming is on the Blu-ray, and it's color corrected, it's cleaned up, it's fully rendered as far as the computer graphics elements goes. And if it was done not retroactively, but like after the movie came out for the home video release, there are a lot of deleted scenes in the MCU films, and they never ever decided to...
I was thinking the same thing.
It's such a disappointment because you'd think that for such a general audience, they would actually go the extra mile to render those. And
I guess they're just so overworked and they're moving on to the next project all the time. It's like, oh, good, you just finished Black Panther by the skin of your teeth.
Oh, you're right.
And now we have to do Infinity War. Have fun. Oh, okay.
That's true.
Yeah. So I guess in that case.
Yeah, there's a lot of different visual effects houses working on movies these days. And when people... when film studios commission CGI effects, they go to multiple houses now instead of... Because in the past, you know, back in the good old days, it was just like Industrial Light and Magic is doing the whole thing for the whole movie. For example, I think like Pirates of the Caribbean.
Oh, Wesa, yeah. I actually brought this up about 10 minutes ago, I think. 10 minutes ago in the movie, I should say. That's weird. But... I was marveling at that. God, stop making puns and double entendres and everything. Anyway, yes, I was marveling at the fact that a lot of Hollywood movies now have about 10 different studios working on it. And then back then, it was only one. And I was just thinking, okay, so that would have been harder than, like, you know, making Gollum or Jar Jar with the technology mm-hmm. they had then. Surely you would need more studios then working on it just because one single computer is this weak.
Yeah,
at the time.
I mean, that's not to say that they only had one computer when they were doing it, but
no, I mean just like an individual working on. So if you've got a room of like, I don't know, 30 animators, each individual computer only can do so much, whereas like just sitting around waiting for things to render.
No, that's absolutely true.
So I don't know what. Is it just that there's more visual effects?
Yes. I think what I can say just by... Okay, so for anybody listening who doesn't know, I like making movies. I've been making movies ever since I was 10. Unfortunately, I'm on a hiatus. It was a 10-year hiatus now, which is very shameful of me, but, you know, that's... But that doesn't mean I don't continue learning about how the industry works and how, you know, how movies are made. So in my observation... For something that we were talking about, which is the case on computer graphics and effects houses, I think that now with more technology, with more people filming, everybody's filming digitally now, there are more movies coming out, there are more movies that have... And I think that there's an artificial demand for more visual effects. And I think the demand comes from not only film studios, but also production studios wanting to put less time into, let's say, filming everything on set and saying, we can do it in post, we can do it after. And so not taking the time to actually create everything practically on the set, and therefore it's cheaper to produce the film when you're filming it because you're doing less days, you don't have as much stuff to worry about on set. You just record what you can on green screen and say that you're going to put something else, you know, in post. And big studios do this too.
I was going to say, with Lord of the Rings, a lot of that was just sort of perspective tricks. It really wasn't anything in post-production, or not very much in post-production. It was more, you know, you'd film someone against a green screen and then just pop them in to the scene, which is not that complicated.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, but I feel like Lord of the Rings was a unique case because they were kind of the first people to actually do something so big and puts so much reliance on digital technology to make it work. But even if you did look at the behind the scenes and see what they were up to, it wasn't, I mean, they did make and build sets, you know, they didn't just, you know, rely on having to do it all in post. So it was a big combination of that. And back in early 2000s, I think that they and the Star Wars prequels were the ones that kind of pioneered expanding the technology, not just for making computer graphics characters, but also for enhancing sets or compositing people together that weren't in the same take, you know. And I feel like this is all great. I love that stuff. But then I feel like when more and more people understood how this technology worked, more and more studios started saying, hey, we can save money and we can save time when we're filming. We don't have to pay the actors so much for all the time that they're spending filming this movie. We don't have to
treat animators like slaves.
Yeah, and that is the big problem. I think that's where the sadness comes in, because now that you're not, you know, giving set designers and production designers and people working in construction,
even costume designers now.
Costume design. Oh man, yeah. Oh, Avengers Endgame, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's really incredible. But so I'm making my Ozymandias costume right now, and the costume, it's a gold bodysuit. So gold stretch fabric is a son of a bitch to work with. It is very wrinkly. It is going to show a lot of those details, even if you make it super skin tight. And it's quite light stretch fabric as well. There's just nothing you can do. And I'm just standing in the mirror going, but it should be just absolutely flawless. And I realize, no, what you're comparing that to in your mind is the Spider-Man costume in you know, the new Spider-Man movies. It's like, that is digital. That is physically impossible.
You mean the ones that don't exist in the physical world.
They literally cannot do that.
Yeah.
The only way you can get around it, tying it back to Prometheus, is using a heavy sort of a wetsuit type material. So the EVA suits in this film are neoprene, and I've got a pretty good replica.
Neoprene.
But what Janti Yates did with those costumes is added a lot of piping. And if you put piping on an area that bends, like your arms, you're going to get a bit of buckling.
Oh, you mean I'm sorry to interrupt, but you mean the, like, are you talking about the orange seams, or are you just...
No, yes. Okay, so those do also have piping, but... Actually, that's a good thing you mentioned that, so you can compare the two. So the neoprene, it's heavy, so it's not wrinkling in the way, say, thin gold lycra would. But she has gone ahead and put the piping in, so it does buckle a little bit. And she has said in interviews, oh, sometimes I watch that movie and you just go, oh, I wish I could just pinch that in a bit more and change that.
Yeah.
No, that they're not superheroes. It doesn't have to look impossible.
Impossible,
it should
yeah.
actually look quite practical, and that's... Ridley Scott has a pretty good attitude with costumes in that sense, that he wants them to look weathered and lived in. Even these costumes that are state-of-the-art, brand new, mm-hmm. a little bit of weathering, just to make it look real on screen.
Of course, yeah. I'm all about the weathering.
Love weathering. It's kind of nerve-wracking, because if you spend so much time working on a costume, you're so precious about it, and you go, okay, now I'm just going to rub all this crap into it, and I'm going to sand it, and I'm going
to
burn it.
That's why you have to give it to another person to do it. You have to give it to another person.
It's my baby. I got you.
Yep. Your baby needs to grow up, son. He has to learn about life.
God, so yes, the latex
That's interesting,
body suits.
Yeah.
The latex body suits that they wear underneath. So they are actually, one goes under the other, and it's sort of a latex compression suit with the orange piping. That looks form-fitting, flawless perfection because it's so damn tight. And latex, while it's a lot lighter than neoprene, it's just stuck to your body. There's just no space.
Right.
So learning those sorts of things, it takes a long time. I especially see that in the cosplay community, that people know nothing about fabrics. It's like, it's the right color, yeah, but you need velvet, and this is poplin.
Oh. So that's why they always kind of look off when some people make it, and you look at some photos and you're like, there's something not right with that costume.
Yeah.
See, you know what you're talking about. I feel like, I don't know anything about costume design, but I feel like what you keep telling me about fabrics and emphasizing that, it seems like that is, you know, those are your basics. Those are like your fundamentals. If you learn about fabrics, that means you know enough to be able to create what you want and make it look the way you want it to and move the way you want it to.
It's basically like trying to be an artist without the fundamentals of anatomy or color theory.
I was thinking that. Yeah.
Everything you build on top of that is just not going to work because you don't have that foundation. And that's why, so with these EVA suits and the latex suits, they absolutely knew which materials to pick to create the right look. And that's why it looks professional. And the weathering, of course, the weathering always makes it look
professional.
That's another thing. Cosplayers don't weather that often, unless it's armor. Everyone seems to want to do weathered up armor. But if you're, I don't know, Link from The Legend of Zelda, even he, I mean, he's running around. He's a dirty boy. He should look like he's been running around.
He's a dirty boy.
He's a filthy boy. Yeah, he should have some, you know, dust and like mud on his boots. Yeah. Like, go for it. Really make it look like this character has come to life.
Totally agree. I honestly, like, for me, weathering on costumes is like just magical, in my opinion. Like, I feel like it just creates something.
The icing on the cake, literally.
Yeah, you're right. I don't want to segue back to talking about CG houses or anything, but I just wanted to conclude by, I noticed that I didn't finish my thought at the in the middle there, and I wanted to just say that today's problems is there's a lot of people that are capable of making a lot of computer effects now with a lot that require less processing power, or our processing power has advanced since the mid-2000s. CGI is being used to augment the frame more than just making characters or changing, you know, just changing the sky or something. It's used for all kinds of stuff now. So, and that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. But the problem is that studios now tend to want to reduce time for shooting and then just give it to people to edit everything in post and change things in post with the computer graphics. And because construction workers, art directors, people who are involved in making physical things most likely have a union and they're unionized and they have to get paid a certain amount. The unfortunate thing is that computer artists don't have that. And as you said, they're treated like slaves. And that's why we have big problems with the abundance of CGI, not very good CGI. And that also has to do with the time it takes, because like the crunch time is always a lot and the workload is extreme. And I think anybody who's worked in computer graphics knows how easy it is to make something look crappy instead of something look good. And that is a problem we face today.
I think that's the major problem I have with things being more and more animated. It's not what I, as the viewer, am seeing on screen. It's taking jobs away from other departments. So you're basically...
Yeah.
It's the animation sector is becoming like the U.S. military. Like, there's a little bit of the budget going to everything else, and then there's
absolutely
just animation.
Yeah, and no one's getting any benefits from that animation either. Like, no one's getting benefits from that job because the animators and the compositors and all the CG artists working in these companies probably don't get paid as much as their value and the quality of the product that they create.
Mm.
And we've solved this, I think, back in the day when there's people who are doing set design, there's people who are doing costume design, there's people doing practical effects, there's people doing everything else that is not computer graphics. And I think that we've already solved the quality to payment ratio fairly well. And I think that this is just an attempt of studios, like production budgets, to save money, you know? And it's being used and it's like alchemy, you know? You can't just create easy jobs and make things go faster without sacrificing something else. You know what I mean? Like that kind of thing.
Yeah, shit, I'm trying to remember. I was going to be like, oh yeah, you have to sacrifice something
exactly,
of equal value,
exactly.
Whatever the hell it is.
I
can't remember Full Metal Alchemist right now.
Something like that. That's what I mean. And so it's like you can't, unfortunately, you still can't get away with saving time and money and effort by making something just as good as something that people take their time to make good. I don't know what I'm talking about anymore. Anyway, you get it. You get it. People listening. I think you got it right.
But what?
Cool. I'm done talking about that.
But yes, getting back to Prometheus. So what I like about Monster Fifield.
Yes. All right. So Fifield the ape is...
Yeah, he's a bit simian. He's got a little bit of simian spice, got a little bit of simian flavor. He's a bit froggy. He's like a frog ape, something or other.
Yeah, seems like it.
And I think that the monkey frog Fifield, it actually reads a lot better as what it's trying to be at the very least. Because, as we were saying before,
yeah,
the other one, it just looks like a zombie. And that's all I can see, and I think most people will only ever see that.
Power Rangers villain.
The only downside is, it might look too comical. Maybe I'm trying to think, like a test audience watching this, do they think it's a little too cartoony? Does it take them too far out of it?
I don't know. Like, this is cartoony as well. This feels like a, like I said, it looks like a Power Rangers villain. It doesn't... When I first saw this film, I remember just thinking, let's get it over with. Come on. Let's go.
Yeah, I'm not totally in love with either, but I do think the CGI version is an improvement almost primarily because it is CGI and you have that uncanny valley, you have that distance. He's become something else, but there's a little bit of Fifield left. They've actually retained a lot of his features, which is interesting. So, I gave you some homework last time.
I was just about to say, you did.
Everybody.
I successfully...
It's been like a whole year, maybe more, but he watched Annihilation. Congratulations.
I did. Thank you. Thank you. I actually did. Yeah. All right. And now I understand what you're talking about, because I kept talking on and on and on about how I always wanted the... I expected something as, I mean, just like something as lofty as creation and these big themes about, you know, your origins and, you know, the gift of life and blah, blah, blah with extraterrestrials. And I felt like, oh, that's, I mean, like for a spinoff of Alien, because Alien is such a crazy, grotesque design. It has an interesting life cycle. Perfect, right? And I thought that if you're going to make something that feels cold and, you know, and uncaring, you would do something that, generally speaking, is just like people finding out, you know, the origins of, let's say, where they came from in this movie. But it's beyond your comprehension, you know? It's not here to kill you. It doesn't care about you. And in that case... I mean, look, you can go to any planet in our solar system and it's uninhabitable. You have to wear something or else you're going to die. And I feel like this could be like that tenfold, you know what I mean? It's something that you can't comprehend that's beautiful and big and it creates life, but I mean, it doesn't care about you and you're going to, and if you're in its way, it's going to change that. And now that you mentioned it, yeah, I watched Annihilation and there's a lot of similar things going on there too. So now the context is there when you're always like, oh, it's like Annihilation. Yes, it is, but...
Very similar themes.
I don't know. I think it works better if it was in a Prometheus movie in an alternate dimension.
It would, yes, absolutely. I think it would work a lot better as Prometheus or an Alien film because you've got that background there. I mean, I love Annihilation. I don't. Did you enjoy the film?
It was okay.
I just, oh.
I didn't not like it.
it's okay. I love it and I love the soundtrack. I think to me, the music it played a big role in just taking you to this other place and it's spooky and unnerving. And
I like the spooky parts. I didn't like the guitar parts, but you know, this is my personal opinion.
Yeah, listening to the soundtrack, I feel like, and this is the same with Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, not to go on too many tangents, but it's like I'm either in the mood for the guitar, the acoustics parts, or I'm in the mood for the weird, warbly, abstract music. And then with Spider-Man, that soundtrack is like really heartfelt, emotional music. And then, let's fucking do this! So some days I'm all about, like, I want that sort of, you know, gym soundtrack, really energetic kind of thing. And the other times I'm like, I just want to be all melancholy and reflective. And yeah.
For sure.
I love Annihilation, but I think it might have been more impactful as an Alien story because we have that cultural history there with it. We've got a relationship with this idea.
Yes.
And to see that, and we've seen this before, that the xenomorph isn't typically, it's not like a normal animal. It's not preying upon you for food. We've never seen it eat.
Nope.
It wants to reproduce, but it's not, you know, it's not a literal rape. It is not, it doesn't want you. It's just, you are convenient. You are there. And so to kind of build upon those ideas and see this thing within its own environment and to see that it just sort of, it just conquers that environment. It just spreads out like a fungus, and survival and reproduction is its two primary motivations.
And yeah, and I was hoping there would be a reflection of that mystery kind of thing with the space jockey men.
The engineers. I think it's an unavoidable thing, and the script writers talk about that too. It's just, we are tapping to such monumental concepts, and how do you do it in a way that satisfies everyone? Because again, it is an established franchise. People do have a personal relationship with it. So when you start revealing all these things, like the engineers are actually white marble statues underneath the trunk, or David created the xenomorph.
People didn't like that.
It's very divisive, because you're going in there and rewriting history in a way. And you're erasing, effectively, the stories that some people had told themselves. Whereas I think I'm fortunate that, I mean, I'd always liked Alien, but I think my major entry point, the thing that really got me hooked, was Alien Covenant. And so that is my idea of this universe. So I'm not dealing with having to accept this contradictory view. The only thing might be in this minute here, where you've just got a guy in monster makeup, and he is just doing the usual monster bullshit where he's attacking everything in sight. Yeah, he's just,
yeah.
What am I to take out of this? It's your typical, just he's gone rabid, he's savage. Okay, that's not really interesting. Whereas the bear, that bear monster in Annihilation, that,
dude, the bear monster, love the bear monster.
That's just, it's a really suspenseful scene, because it's, is it alive? Is it not? It's got a skull for a face. And then it's
what is it doing?
Yeah, it's mimicking the scream of this woman who died in the previous scene. And he's just, oh, I don't know what this thing is. I don't know what it's about. And he doesn't really attack, I don't think. It's not a violent scene. Everyone's just sitting there, just absolutely terrified. And that's far more effective to me than, I'm going to fuck you up, guys, and I'm going to smash your helmet and Hulk smash. Okay.
Yeah. Thinking of those ideas in Annihilation, and then you could just easily put that in with what we have here with Fifield, and you could have played with that so well. And now that you mentioned it, I'm going, oh!
Maybe he is still able to retain some of his faculties. I mean, we do see evidence in this scene where he's still using tools.
Yeah.
I didn't notice this before. He grabs an axe and starts to wield it. So he's able to use weapons and tools.
See, that's great, and it sounds interesting,
yes.
But in this scene in particular, it's just like, yeah, we get, yeah, you know, like you relate it to just being like crazy killer man, you know, you don't really think.
This feels like filler. It's basically, oh, we need another action sequence, so I guess we'll do this. It doesn't feel like this is propelling the story in any meaningful way. Whereas if you could see, okay, maybe he's still able to talk. Maybe he's being manipulative. Maybe he's able to, because that's the thing, is a xenomorph is the ultimate predator. So if we see this basically xenomorph human hybrid, and it's doing things, it's strategic in a way we've never seen before. There's just, you've opened up so many possibilities, and we didn't get them.
It sucks, man. I'm so disappointed now. This is the most disappointing podcast, because you're just opening up these great ideas that will never be fulfilled. Will there be an Alien 3? Will there be one? I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know, man. It's not my job, but I would if I could. I say this a lot. I would honestly settle for just Ridley Scott filming Michael Fassbender in his backyard on his phone, and that's it. That's all I need. I don't care. Just finish it. Finish what you started.
Yeah.
It must be frustrating, but I think I also serve a purpose in just proposing all these new imaginative possibilities. So I'm kind of remedying the prequel pain.
The pains of the prequel. I really wonder how this is going
to... Maybe I should write the third one.
Maybe you should. Get an agent, write it down.
I'm very slow at writing.
Well, that's one of the big problems then, because that's what the film industry is not about. It's not about taking your time. You got to make product.
Well, they've got easy access to cocaine, so it makes a huge difference.
Okay.
yes, getting back on track. So, another notable bit of trivial detail in this minute is that if you pause on the muzzle flashes on the guns, you can see something quite odd. It's a kind of a blue phaser glow, but they are seemingly firing bullets, but the sound is wrong.
I noticed
well.
That, yeah.
I don't know why.
Why?
This is Alien, where, like, aliens, lots of guns, war-to-war guns, non-stop guns, all day, every day. So, why have we got phases here? I've tried really hard to come up with some sort of explanation, but I got nothing.
I don't know, it kind of feels like Ridley Scott just didn't want to watch any of the older Alien films. I can relate to this because I know that sometimes I just think that I know, I remember everything, and I want to go with my instincts for something that would be a continuity with something older. And
never trust your memory, never.
But it's so easy to just remember how it is instead of watching it again.
I definitely know. Or just in this recording alone, I was talking about the deleted scene. I'm like, oh wait, but the bit at the beginning was there, Connor. You watched it literally 10 minutes ago. How the fuck have you forgotten?
Yeah.
God damn.
Well, you know, that's just how it goes.
My issue with this, the blue phaser nonsense, is that it doesn't have the same impact. You're not, especially, I think the big issue is down to sound design. It doesn't sound like something hitting something else where there's that real, like in John Wick, where there's like,
no.
You know, that real, there's a punch to it. And I never thought I would need to, but I did, in fact, consult the Internet Movies Firearm Database, and it was able to shed a little light. Oh, firstly, so you sort of need this background information, I suppose. I found this interesting note on their Alien page. So before investigating the derelict ship, Dallas, Tom Skerritt, tells the crew to break out the weapons, the larger of which was based on the Swiss Rexham Faber, and the other is based on the Wembley Jr. Mark II air pistol. According to the novelization of the film, these were laser pistols.
Lasers.
So, firstly, this is probably just Alan Dean Foster making up his own bullshit again. Yeah. Or was this in some of the scripts? Was this actually discussed behind the scenes? Did Ridley envision this being a world with phasers or laser pistols?
And if that's the case, why wasn't that the case in Aliens? Plural.
Well, that I could probably understand, because I don't think Ridley has either watched those films or watched them recently or closely, and he sort of dismissed them as continuity. He's not really concerned with making any homages or tying anything in there. He's just primarily focused on his Alien and building from that story. So, yeah, maybe he just went, oh, okay, yeah, James Cameron did a thing, but I'm doing my own thing, so,
Perhaps.
So, as for the handgun scene here, a Walter GSP expert, most likely the 32 S&W automatic, whatever that means, with a configuration similar to that of the 22 pistol, are used by the crew members of the Prometheus. The 32 is generally identified with the extended magazine and blue finish. If you're following this at home, good, I don't know what any of this means. I'm Australian. The closest thing I got to a gun was a Nerf gun. So, like the M3T Super 90, the shotgun also used in the scene, the Walter GSP's feature, blue muzzle flashes. The page also contains images showing the muzzle flashes were normal in pre-release footage. So in I think in the trailer, but in early test footage and stuff, it's just normal. So they just, I don't know, someone came and went, it should be blue. Make it blue.
Just make it blue. Looks sci-fi and cool.
Yeah. That's all I can imagine. And I suppose you can say, well, like the ship, the Prometheus itself, it is seemingly more advanced technology than what we see in Alien, and maybe it's just some prototype that Weyland created that we never see again. So, okay, we can go with that one. This is been an episode of bullshit excuses. I'm sick of it, Ridley Scott.
I guess so. I mean, like, what can you do?
I'm going to track down Ridley Scott. Drag him on this podcast. He's got a lot to answer for. Well, I think that's as good a time as any to wrap things up. Thank you once again, Phil.
You're welcome.
If you want to let people know where they can find you, now is the time to do it. Speak or forever hold your peace until
fantastic.
The next minute.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, as Connor mentioned at the beginning, I'm from a podcast called Twofold, and if you would kindly go to twofoldpodcast.com, I think is the actual URL. I'm notorious for forgetting. We talk about a new movie, an old movie, and with my co-hosts, Tim and Jake, and we always have a fun time arguing and being mean to each other. So you can go and check that out, twofoldpodcast.com. It's fun. Yeah, it's every 2 weeks, too.
Yeah. Well, I now have a Patreon. I never thought I would have one because I just thought I don't have anything for people and I miss the deadlines.
Oh, hey.
I'm very hard on myself because I used to be a very efficient, reliable person, never miss a deadline. Now it's like, well, it's been 2 weeks. I guess I should, I don't know, brush the dust off this microphone and record something.
Aww.
Yeah. But now I've set up the Patreon and we'll see how it goes. So a few people were asking about it and I just went, all at once actually I should say, I just went, okay, I guess it's a sign, I guess I should do it, all right.
Wow.
And you can, so the lower tier is just, it starts at $5 a month and you can get early episodes of Prometheus. And then further up, you'll get, on the higher tiers, I should say, Alien Covenant in advance. So I have actually recorded the first episode of that, and that's available now. And which was really surreal. It's just, oh, I haven't finished Prometheus yet. It's like I've skipped ahead to the final boss battle. This is weird. I shouldn't be allowed to do this. But I think I got enough experience. But the third tier, you can get advanced episodes of Prometheus, Covenant Minute, and Legacy Minute, which is the Tron Legacy Minute, which I have recorded the first episode for. And then the uppermost tier is where you can just tell me what to do. You can tell me what you want me to review, and I'll do these little special episodes where I'll do like, you know, half hour review of whatever you want.
Sounds awesome.
Alright, that about covers it. This is Colson signing off. You can find me on TravianDesigns.com, TravianAN, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook, and now, Patreon.com/TravianDesigns.
Nice. This is me signing off.